step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. LaDonna Humphrey gains a new ally in her effort to find justice in the 1994 unsolved murder case of Melissa Ann Witt, when Alicia Lockhart reveals a dark and troubling secret from her past. Together, Humphrey and Lockhart must delve inside a dangerous and twisted world known as the Dark Web to unlock a series of mysteries, including Alicia's haunting connection to Melissa Witt's murder. Strangled is the shocking and suspenseful account of the war Humphrey and Lockhart wage on a warped and depraved online community set on destruction, murder, and mayhem. The stakes are high. Their safety is compromised. Evil lurks with every click. Just how far are they willing to go to find the answers they need? The book that we're featuring this evening is Strangled, with my special guests, authors and podcasters, LaDonna Humphrey and Alicia Lockhart. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, LaDonna Humphrey and Alicia Lockhart.
Thank you so much. We're excited to be here.
Yes, thank you for having us.
And congratulations on this extraordinary book. Let's start off first with you, LaDonna. To put this in perspective, you appeared on the True Murder podcast not so long ago with The Girl I Never Knew regarding the Melissa Witt murder. Tell us about the genesis and the origins of this book, Strangled.
You know, I did. And thank you for the opportunity to be on the podcast before. And now here I am again. But yes, I did release my first book, The Girl I Never Knew. And essentially that is a journey of my 7, almost 8 years now that I've spent hunting for justice for the 1994 murder of Melissa Witt. And through the course of writing the book, a tip came in to my team. And that tip was from Alicia Lockhart. And that's really what the beginnings of Strangled is that tip from Alicia. You know, we didn't know it then that there was going to be a book and a podcast and everything that we've done since. But when she sent that tip in, it was so intriguing and frightening. And it was also something that we knew that we had to look into because it could be potentially linked to the murder of Melissa Witt. And really through that process, I got to know Alicia and we started working together and really became clear, you know, almost from the word go, that she and I had this synergy and this passion and this drive to find justice, you know, for a girl neither of us have ever known. And that quickly blossomed into what we needed to do in terms of telling the world that there is an entire community out there online that's known as Death Fetish. And essentially that is how Strangled was born.
So Alicia, you talk about in chapter 1, which is appropriately called Dark Secrets, in May 2021, Your Darkest Secret. Tell us what that Your Darkest Secret was and how you were involved in the Death Fetish community.
Yeah, that was a very intense time for me back in May 2021. I happened to be starting a YouTube channel about spiritual topics. And I was mainly wanting to just focus on astral projection, lucid dreaming, things like that. And I was feeling really nervous to start this little YouTube channel. And I wound up talking to my sister about that nervousness. And we just got into this deep conversation about, you know, things that make us anxious and secrets that we had. And it brought up this very strange memory that I had. I guess I wouldn't call it a repressed memory, but it was something I had really forgotten about and something that I had not ever really shared with anybody. And that secret was that many, many years before, I had actually modeled for a small-time pornographer in Portland, Oregon. And the video that he asked me to model in was a death fetish video. It was morgue pornography.
Tell us a little more about this pornography and what you were asked to do in this role.
Yeah, it was a very unique video in that the producer was calling it a pornography, but it didn't actually have any sexual activity involved. I guess it was a pornography because the nature of the video was sexual for the viewers.
Right.
People who have death fetishes, they can, you know, watch a video of girl posing lifeless in a morgue and I suppose glean sexual gratification just from viewing a body on a morgue slab. And so in this video, this producer, he wanted to film me limp and lifeless in a variety of settings and positions. And he would pick up my limbs and flop them around. And he dragged me a little bit around on the floor and, you know, just some very strange footage that he was taking of me. But the thing that stood out in my memory about this film that I had modeled for was that it was very important to the producer that I be wearing a Mickey Mouse watch while being filmed as a strangulation victim in this video.
Now, in keeping with these memories that reoccurred, resurfaced, and you shared with your sister, you listened to a true crime podcast, True Crime Garage.
Yes.
And what was the nature, or what was the episode about, and who did you get introduced inadvertently to via that podcast?
Well, my sister actually directed me to that podcast because she had done a Google search about Mickey Mouse watches. And she just felt like the memory I shared with her was very creepy. Mm-hmm. And it reminded her of like a serial killer trophy. And so she was curious if there was any sort of cold case that had a detail like that, like a victim that perhaps had a Mickey Mouse watch. And so she wound up finding that True Crime Garage podcast, and it was an episode about the cold case of Melissa Witt from Arkansas. And it was actually a podcast where LaDonna Humphrey was speaking. She was telling the hosts about Melissa's case and just advocating for Melissa on the podcast.
Now, you found LaDonna's website and you were intrigued by the banner that said immediately, somebody knows something. But you also thought back to the producer of the film that you worked for and tried to get a phone number or a contact from the past. Tell us what you did in that regard, and then tell us about your eventual contact with LaDonna.
As I listened to that podcast and learned more about Melissa Witt and about how she had been wearing a Mickey Mouse watch when she was abducted and strangled and how that watch was never recovered, I became a little bit concerned that this watch that I had worn in the film may have been Melissa's watch or a different murder victim's watch, but it just seemed very eerie and an important lead to report and to follow up with. And I was so concerned about it that I felt almost panicked, like I needed to either reach out to the police or reach out to LaDonna and her team about this experience that I had had. And I felt so strongly about it that I also tried to contact the producer I had worked for, just thinking that he would feel the same way that I had about putting those pieces together in my mind. But when I tried to contact him, not surprisingly, the phone number that I had for him from all those years ago was disconnected.
Now, LaDonna, tell us about this meeting and this contact with Alicia, and what does it make you realize, or how do you feel about this sudden change in direction?
Well, and that's exactly what it was, Dan. It was a sudden change in direction. And to say that it put Melissa's case, you know, in a new light, I mean, it lit it on fire. It was, you know, I can remember where I was, what I was doing, everything that happened when that tip came through. And it was something that it took me all day to process, to think that this could actually even be the direction that the Witt case could take. You know, it's hard enough to think that this 19-year-old was murdered in the fashion in which she was, but then to consider that death fetish could be involved, because I had never heard of death fetish before. And so, you know, as I always do, I take that tip to police. And, you know, we really talked about it back and forth before I ever responded to Alicia. One, because we all took very seriously, you know, it in a cold case, as you know, it's very common that you'll just continue to get some of the same information regurgitated over and over and over again, even if it's inaccurate, because you know how misinformation spreads and, you know, legend develops. But this was not anything that we'd ever heard before, which made it intriguing. The detail about the Mickey Mouse watch, it was really overwhelming for our team because, you know, as I talked about in The Girl I Never Knew, you know, we believe and law enforcement believe that Melissa's killer kept that Mickey Mouse watch as some sort of, you know, memento, you know, a token, something, because it meant something to him. So yeah, this lead with Alicia, it had to be pursued and quickly. And, you know, when we were able to have that first discussion with Alicia, it became very clear that this was something that we were going to have to see to the very end, because this was not anything that we could have ever, you know, thought up on our own. And just the circumstances in which she found our team and then came forward, and that act of bravery, we really felt like we needed to link arms with her and help get to the bottom of that, no matter what it was. And that's really how it all started.
You asked Alicia more details about this film shoot. And one of the details she gave you was that he had said that this was for a private collector and that no one would see this film, giving her some assurance of some semblance of privacy after she had done this for $500. Now, how do you move forward with Alicia to investigate Carl, or the person she knew as Carl, this filmmaker?
It was a very complicated investigation in the beginning, because we needed to glean all the information from Alicia that we could and from her memory. And we can kind of touch base on that as we talk about why maybe her memory wasn't great about some of the details. But we really needed to be able to understand what we were dealing with. And there were just a couple of scenarios. Either Carl Coleman potentially knew something about Melissa Witt's murder, or the person that had commissioned the film for him knew something about Melissa Witt's murder.
Right.
Or they were just absolutely more depraved than we could have ever imagined, and they were trying to simulate this murder or something like it. And it was just a lot of fact finding. And it became pretty clear early on that we needed to find the film and that we needed to find all of the characters that were involved in this. And Alicia was, I'm going to kick it over to her a little bit. She was instrumental in that, not just because of her bravery, but it became really clear that she had some pretty phenomenal super sleuthing skills. I mean, just amazing. And between that and the synergy that she and I had together, I mean, we were on a mission, because one, we needed to find these answers about Melissa Witt. And two, there are people out there making films about the glorification of the murder of women. Both of those things are not okay. And you know, all of a sudden the universe had weaved us together for a mission.
Absolutely.
So Alicia, what are some of the things that you employ, the strategies that you employ to be able to go undercover and be able to do this investigation the way you think that it should be done, in terms of to glean some information from these people that live a very secretive life?
Well, what we discovered about this community is that there are a lot of, gates and checkpoints to get into these areas where they feel comfortable to speak freely about their sexual desires towards, well, I guess just necrophilia acts and their fantasies about murder and rape and assault. And that makes sense to me. They're not comfortable speaking about those topics out in the open. So did take a lot of digging around on the internet and just using different search engines, different search terms, I guess petitioning or applying to get into these websites with different email addresses than my own personal information, just trying to create some space and distance there between this community of dangerous people and myself. And we definitely both were using, I guess, just virus software on our computers and using VPNs to mask our IP addresses when we were going into these sites. Those are really important tools for when you're going undercover in an area of the internet that you feel is dangerous.
And I think I would add to that too. We had to blend in, Dan. We had to find a way to blend in with these people so we could build some trust and we could get the information that we needed and almost become one of them. And that was incredibly difficult. It was a psychological game that I don't ever suggest that anybody take on unless they have, you know, the blessing of law enforcement and access to a therapist, for sure.
Now, looking for this Carl Coleman, you look under other handles and you think you find somebody that looks to be possibly Carl, and he's called the coroner.
Yes.
You find videos and you find information and posts by the coroner. What do you find out about Carl Coleman that you think is just simply a filmmaker? What do you find out about Carl Coleman?
So when I knew Carl Coleman in person and accepted that modeling gig, he had posed as a less dangerous type of pornographer. I had seen him filming clown pornography, actually, during my job interview. And he made it seem like this morgue film that we were making together was a very strange one-off request of this private client of his. But as I was digging around in these death fetish communities, these gated communities, I did take notice of this user named the coroner, who was always advertising these strangling videos for the death fetishers to purchase and use as pornography. And I was searching for hosting sites of these videos, because those are another level of security. They will post about their films in the death fetish forums, but then to view the films or purchase the films, you have to go through another gated process most of the time. So I was spending a lot of time going through the coroner's advertisements, looking for a website that I would be able to get into and view the films. And I finally did find that and discovered that this user named the coroner was the same man that had filmed me, and that he wasn't a general producer or pornographer. He specialized in death fetish films, in simulated snuff films. And most of his videos, of which he has thousands, are videos of him strangling women with various tools.
And Dan, it's frightening, because you know, you see all that inside the fetish forums and communities, and then you do a deep dive into his public, what was then public, social media accounts, and you start seeing the problems that he has in his real life with relationships and his ability to function as a normal, productive human being. And you start to paint a picture, things that he said about himself and things that you learn about him. It becomes very clear that he's unstable and he's borderline dangerous with these desires that he has to make these films. It was really an eye-opening experience, I think, for both of us.
Absolutely.
Now, LaDonna and Alicia, both of you want to gain information from this Coleman in relation to the Melissa Witt murder. And there are some things that allude to him possibly being at that place to be able to be murdering at that time. Now, Alicia, how do you go about luring him to believe he is corresponding with someone else? And tell us the nature of that correspondence. What are some of the things that you want to gain from him?
Well, At that point, I was doing a lot of back-end research about his life, his company, his films. And while I was capturing screenshots of a blog that he had written for many years about his personal experiences, LaDonna was actually communicating directly with him as one of the characters we had developed for the Death Fetish Forum.
Yeah, what I decided to do with the blessing of law enforcement was to go undercover to get to know him under a different name. I used the name Fawn. And he started corresponding with Fawn almost immediately. I mean, it was pretty clear that he was just hungry for, you know, attention. And, you know, it just started off slowly. It was, you know, just an exchange of information. And within a matter of days, he was professing his love for Fawn. I mean, it became very surreal. And I just carefully tried to extract the information from him that I could. It got so intense so quickly that it actually became clear to me that he was really trying to groom Fawn for something else, perhaps to lure her into a film, who knows what. But I mean, he was all in. And this went on for some time until he did finally admit at one point that he had spent time in Arkansas, and he mentioned, you know, Highway 23, which is one of two routes that you could take in the Ozark National Forest to actually reach the area where Melissa Witt's body was discovered. And that, to me, was frightening at that point. I mean, that to me, you know, was life altering, because, you know, here he is admitting that he has had, you know, ties to forestry work, which, you know, her body's found in the Ozark National Forest, and he also is into strangling, and that was her cause of death. And now he's saying, you know, yes, I was in, you know, the Ozark National Forest at that time. It was overwhelming. And it probably was one of the things that have happened in the case for the first time that I felt the most frightened. And I've dealt with a lot of crazy things in this case, but this was really frightening because he is so into death and into murder and into strangulation. And I felt fearful for all of us.
Tell us about Fête Noire, the forum for the death fetish community.
Fête Noire is another gated death fetish community website. And Fête Noire was created by Carl Coleman. And he says that he created this community to be a safe space for women to express themselves and talk about death fetish. And so he started this website with two other usernames that were women. And as we were researching this page that he had created, it became pretty apparent that these other monikers, the other admin of this site, were very likely just Carl Coleman himself running the whole thing, acting or posing as different people. So that was quite disturbing as well, to just get in there and feel like we were, I don't know, flies in a web of death fetish in Carl Coleman's twisted world.
At the same time, part of the investigation is that you're trying to contact potential models of Carl Coleman. So what is any success with that effort?
Well, I would say we had some success in that we were able to locate a handful of models just from doing reverse image searches and good research online. We're able to find some models and have a little bit of a back and forth with a few of them. But the information that they shared was frightening, and it became very clear that we had reason to believe this man was dangerous. Some of the other women that had worked with him were terrified to speak with us. It was very hard to get the models that we found to talk very much about him. One of them shared a lot of information, though, and we were just shocked to hear some of the things that she had to say. And she is still terrified to go public with any of the information that she shared.
There is another woman, when you look at this investigation into Melissa Witt and the Mickey Mouse watch and its importance. And then you speak of a Melissa Trotter, 19 years old. She was found strangled. Tell us about Melissa Trotter and its connection, if any, to this Melissa Witt investigation?
Well, I can say that, right up front, Melissa Trotter's case has always been looked at pretty closely as something that could be related to the Witt case because they're both 19 years old. They were both abducted. They were both abducted in December, almost exactly 4 years apart. And they're both found 50 to 60 miles away from their abduction site in a national forest. And there was another gentleman who was executed for the murder of Melissa Trotter. And his name was Larry Swearingen. And he was looked at as a potential suspect in the Witt case as well. And so what made it interesting about Carl Coleman is that he's also from the area in which Melissa Trotter went missing and was found murdered and actually admitted to being in that area the same year that this happened. And so, of course, it made us take some pause. And several of the movies depict a scenario in which could be very similar, Alicia, wouldn't you say, to Trotter's murder?
Yeah, there was one video that it just gives me chills to recount because there's a model posed laying on the ground with these white socks and she's wearing tennis shoes and one of her shoes has fallen off. And so she's laying there with one shoe on and one shoe off with her white socks showing. And there are photographs of Melissa Trotter's body that you can find online. And that's exactly what her body looked like when she was found.
Now you talk about the undercover work that you're speaking to Carl Coleman, but LaDonna, explain why you end this correspondence and explain what his response is.
You know, honestly, I had to end the correspondence with Carl because it was taking an emotional toll on me. I did have to start seeing a therapist weekly based on the things that I was seeing and hearing in these forums and the communication with Carl and how he's, you know, pushing me to meet people in Fete Noir and all of the things that he was doing and saying that started to point more and more to perhaps he had some knowledge about the murder of Melissa Witt. And, you know, after we were able to glean the information from him that he had been in Arkansas and, you know, he mentioned the Ozark National Forest, it was pretty clear, you know, to my team and to investigators that communication needed to be cut. And as I tried to do that, he responded very, very violently and threateningly. And was just very unhappy that Fawn was no longer going to be, you know, giving Mr. Coleman all of her attention. And it was actually kind of a scary response. And I was relieved when we ended the relationship. But, you know, he did continue to try to communicate with me, with LaDonna, not with Fawn, because during this process, he was able to get some information from me that, you know, he grabbing IP addresses and, you know, pulling back VPNs and all kinds of secretive things that they're able to do in these forums. And they doxed me in the community. And it just, I mean, Alicia, wouldn't you say it just kind of exploded all at once? I mean, it was like a bomb went off almost.
Death fetishers in the community, it became clear that some of them have some pretty good hacking abilities. The things that they were able to discover about us were frightening.
Let's use this, Alicia and LaDonna, to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is HelloFresh. Subscribe to HelloFresh and check save money off your fall to-do list. HelloFresh is 25% cheaper than takeout and less expensive than grocery shopping as well. It's time to cozy up and save money by cooking at home. Fall is the perfect time to experience the delicious taste and unparalleled convenience of HelloFresh. HelloFresh works with your ever-changing schedule. Plans are flexible and you can choose your meals for the week, update your preferences, or change your delivery day all in the HelloFresh app. Changing seasons mean changing tastes, and with 30-plus weekly recipes to choose from, HelloFresh has something for everyone. Easily customize your meals by swapping proteins or sides, upgrading to choice proteins, or adding protein to a veggie meal. My wife Lisa and I share cooking duties. With HelloFresh, we save time going to the grocery store, and with pre-portioned ingredients and delicious recipes, HelloFresh makes meals super easy and fast. go to HelloFresh.com/TrueMurder65 and use code TrueMurder65 for 65% off plus free shipping. Go to HelloFresh.com/TrueMurder65 and use code TrueMurder65 for 65% off plus free shipping. HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. Now, LaDonna and Alicia, we were talking about you had to end, LaDonna, you had to end this toxic correspondence, but your investigation continued. Now he had your address, your phone number, you were seeing a therapist. What about Fetnoir and the pressure that you put on this death site? What happened as a result? And how does this story continue?
Well, I will start, and I want Alicia to jump in, but this is where I start to get really, really riled up. And I think that Alicia does too, because their response to finding out that we were doing and, you know, some investigating in their community was really telling, because they shut Fetnoir down. They took it offline. There were several sites that completely shut down. They shut down a podcast. They shut down, you know, a blog, and they started scattering. And that told us everything we needed to know. You know, did it mean that they knew something about the death of Melissa Witt? Not necessarily, but it really did indicate that there was some illegal activity or knowledge of illegal activity happening within those forums. And, you know, Alicia, I can remember several discussions that you and I had talking about that very thing, about, you know, what did this mean and why were they scattering the way that they were?
Absolutely. And I remember we were watching to see what they were going to do. And we basically agreed, well, if we're wrong and there is no illegal activity going on and Carl Coleman has nothing to do with the Witt case or the Trotter case, then they're not going to be scared of us and they're going to leave their website up and they'll just kind of forget about us. But that was not the case. They were terrified to have people looking around in their forums.
They were terrified, and I think they were also angry, because then what starts to happen, Dan, is that they start to invade our personal life. They start to send text messages and call us and send flowers to my home and, you know, contact us in a variety of ways to frighten and bully us and to try to deter us from this mission that we're on to find justice for Melissa Witt. And now potentially to find justice for maybe some of the girls that are being abused and other illegal activity that's happening within these forums. And that's what's even more disturbing, is that they've gone to great lengths to try to put Alicia and I in a position where we would be frightened and run away. And that's, I think, one of the things that makes Alicia and I such a great team, is that Alicia and I, it's almost like, you know, even though we live all these miles away from each other, it's just like we looked at each other and winked and stood our ground and said, no, not one more girl. We're not going to move until we get the information we need, until we put a stop to any illegal activity that's going on.
Now, Alicia, you say to LaDonna, despite her fear and likely your fear, that you need to go deeper. Explain what you mean by going deeper, and what do you do? Talk about Desert Princess.
Well, at this point, when we discovered that these fetishers knew our identities and that they were trying to scare us out of their community, to scare us from discovering the truth about who they were and what they were doing, I just felt very strongly that we were on to something and that we needed to keep going. We needed to discover why this was life or death for them. And I really felt strongly that we were not going to be able to get to that next level in our investigation without becoming one of them, becoming a trusted member of their community. And it was hard for us to make this decision, but we did decide together that instead of just kind of tiptoeing around these communities, that we needed to develop characters that people could get to know and feel comfortable with so that we would still be able to get more information and perhaps even insider information. And so you did mention Desert Princess, and that was one of many monikers that we had in the forums. And we started posting regularly and started just participating in discussions, participating in creating artwork in their community so that we could blend in and have more real conversations with some of the members of the forum.
Tell us about the contact from Horror Man.
Horror Man is he's frightening to me. He's written some very, and I'll let Alicia touch on that, but you know, he's written some very frightening things within the forums. Some things that are so frightening that it could point to knowledge in the Witt case, or so it seems, or maybe obsession with that cold case, you know, however you want to look at it. But he has spent a great amount of time to track me down in my real life, in my home and in my community, send me flowers and do other things to get my attention, to keep me potentially afraid or to run me off. And that has been difficult for my family to deal with, because that's unwanted attention. And obviously, you know, I understand that we've garnered that because the very nature of our investigation. But to think that somebody would go to those links makes you feel like they could be, you know, a sociopath. And maybe they do have some tendencies that could harm, you know, lead to real harm in the real world. And that's how I feel about Horror Man, even to this day. I think Alicia would probably agree with that.
Yeah, something about Horror Man that really struck me as odd is that he, just his writing style in the forums seemed very realistic. It very much felt like you were reading the journal of a serial killer, because there were other people in the forums who would write these very long, detailed, sort of poetic stories about murdering women. But Horror Man would just pop in and write like a 3-line message that said, "Killed another woman by the laundromat, gonna have to move towns again," like, or something kind of like that, that just felt like an admission. So
I think I would add to that, I think that there's something there. There's something to the things that he was writing about, but they're just vague enough within these forums that it's almost impossible to track down who he could be writing about. But she's right. I mean, it did read like the journal of a serial killer. It was definitely not the same flavor of the other fetishers that we were seeing.
Throughout this book and throughout this investigation, near the end, you talk about speculating Carl's importance or connection to Melissa Witt. Tell us what you came up with in terms of his filming and imitation of art imitating life.
You know, I think for me personally, to speak on that in terms of the Witt case and the amount of life investment I have in this case, and now that I have into the death fetish community to find answers for Melissa, it's a frustrating answer, because we don't have a definitive answer. That's what's so frustrating and so mind-boggling. Did he have involvement? We don't know. We can't place him, you know, with tried and true evidence, Dan, that would lead to a conviction. Can we give circumstantial outline of here's where he was, here's what he's doing, and here's what he said, and here's the kind of movies he's made? Absolutely, but that's not enough. And the sheer volume of movies and the sheer amount of the movies that look to be made about real crimes is disturbing. And any way you slice it, Carl Coleman is a dangerous man. Even if he did not murder these women, let's just say he didn't. He's imagining it. He's glorifying it. He's dreaming about it. And he's making movies about it to the tune of thousands and thousands and thousands of movies. And some of these movies, when you see him, you don't know that he's acting. They look real. I mean, we have feared for the safety of many of these models and have tried to track them down, and we can't find them. And it's something that I do lose sleep at night over, and I know that Alicia does too. And I think that's one of the things that drives us to keep going until we can get some answers, because it has to be stopped. And, you know, I could probably preach a lot, you know, so to speak, about the fetishers and these communities. But what's so dangerous about them is that, you know, they say that this is fantasy, but it's not. It's not a healthy outlet that you can just say, well, that's just fantasy. You know, it's like watching a Disney movie. It's not. It's the glorification of murder. And we do know that there's a link between violent porn consumption and real crime. And I mean, I want Alicia to talk talk a little bit about some of the research she's done too, if that's okay, Dan, about the amount of murders that have come out of the fetish community.
Yes, go ahead, Alicia. Tell us.
Yes, there's a staggering connection of these forums, these death fetish forums, and people who go on to commit real life murders. And so we've been researching those the last few months, and we just keep finding more and more and more of them. I would say there's more than 20 cases that we've found so far, where if you really go in and look, you start digging around and reading the court cases, you can find out even what website that these murderers were going on, which ones they were frequenting, how often, how many years they went on, their usernames and what fantasies they spoke about. And you can see this timeline and this escalation process of somebody having a fetish like this, starting to get thoughts. Usually it seems to be around the age 15 is a very common age reported of somebody starting to have a death fetish. And then they, of course, look for content online and find these communities that welcome them with open arms and say, hey, it's okay. We are obsessed with the idea of murdering a woman and having sex with her dead body too. Come on in. Let's all talk about this. We're all normal. And you see people who stay in those communities, they access them more and more and more often. And then it's just not enough. And some of them go on to murder women in real life.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, you talked about strategy to deal with these fetishers that have stalked and harassed and made your lives horrible during this investigation and in this last ensuing more than a year or so. You spoke to an attorney, a couple attorneys. What did they have to say? What did they offer? And what has that grown into?
Well, we have several attorneys at this point. We have almost 14 as of, you know, the date of the publication of this podcast that are willing to give us pro bono services across the United States.
Wow.
To try to tackle these fetishers and these communities and get them shut down. And they want to do this free of charge, which is phenomenal. I mean, this has really struck a chord with a lot of people in the legal community and just in the community in general. And, you know, Alicia and I are really, really determined to get this shut down for everybody's well-being. This is not a healthy sexual outlet. And the fetishers will tell you that it is. They believe that this is an innocent, not a big deal type of a fantasy situation. It isn't. It's, you know, I go back to research after research after research that shows that violent pornography is really very bad for your brain. And it creates scenarios that you want more and more and more and more. And eventually you're not getting enough until you're actually acting out what you've seen. Is that murder? Is it rape? Is it some sort of abuse? It could be all of those things. And so we are joining forces with law enforcement and investigators and attorneys all across the United States. We have to put a stop to this.
In your preface, you talked about an email that appeared in your inbox, and the subject line was Melissa Witt's murder and the death fetish community. And by a sender, the Vermilion Strangler. Now, when you just mentioned this team and your attorneys, they also have an investigator that said that they had found out the identity of this Vermilion Strangler. Tell us about that.
Yes. So there is another character that goes by Jessica X or Necro Girl X or Snuff Princess or a variety of other monikers across the dark web that actually partnered at some point with Carl Coleman. We're not really clear on what that partnership was exactly, you know, some shared interest, obviously, in death fetish, but she is unhealthily invested in seeing Alicia and I stop what we're doing, particularly me. And I'm not really sure why. I think she feels threatened that we might have some power with our punch to be able to get some things done. And it turns out that she's the Vermilion Strangler. She was the one that was emailing me.
Wow.
And it's very, very disturbing that she would go to those links. But she's created a variety of alter egos, monikers, whatever you want to call it, to contact us. And it's bizarre.
Well, I think it's important to mention, too, that she had sort of stepped into the structure of Fête Noir. And I believe she paid a decent amount of money to take over that community in some of the later years. Like, I believe it was 2019 when she stepped in and started running that website. So Jessica and Carl Coleman, they might as well be business partners.
This community, you say Fête Noir and all of these people in the death fetish community that have made threats, but also seem threatened. You say that you essentially shut down a clubhouse for 20,000 people that are interested in this community. However, the fact that it's just illegal pornography and these people would want their privacy, you say that this death fetish community seems to represent much more in terms of real crime and real serious crime like murder.
Yes, I full-heartedly believe that about this community. I believe that there were things that we had not discovered in Fête Noir when it was shut down. And I believe that that is a large part of why the Vermilion Strangler or Jessica Brown or Necro Girl X, whatever she wants to call herself. I think that the fixation on destroying what we're doing, our mission, our work, prying into our personal lives. I think the motivation is there because of some other, I would say, shady business operations that were going on inside of that site that we were not able to document. They pulled it down really fast once they figured out that we were there.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with you, really. I didn't mean to cut you off. I think that she's exactly right. There's more that we weren't able to uncover.
You discuss the DSM-5 and very interesting that I had just been reading about this as well, that a new classification for necrophilia. Can you discuss that?
Yeah, I wasn't sure if Alicia wanted to jump into that or not, but it is considered a mental illness. That's not Alicia and LaDonna making that up. I mean, that is what professionals have labeled necrophilia. And you know, we've tried to express that concern the best way we can when we do communicate with these fetishers, because they do communicate with us often through email, and they will say that it isn't. It's just fantasy. And I want Alicia to touch on that a little more, because, you know, this is something that she and I both have struggled with, some of the things that they're saying, because you can't argue with them. They really believe that we're targeting them. And I believe, if I'm correct, Alicia, their last email to us said that we were targeting, like, they were a protected minority group.
Well, yes. And it's in the DSM-5. I believe that necrophilia is listed as a paraphilia, but it's definitely in there, and it's mental health concern. And they are not open to hearing that feedback from outsiders of their community. And that concerns me greatly, because I do feel that if these death fetish forums were all wiped out, they were not on the web for anybody to find, that somebody at the tender age of 15 looking up death fetish or necrophilia pornography, I do believe if they couldn't find that and what they found instead was information about mental health care, I just would feel much safer in the world, and I would feel like that might be something that they could work through as they grew older, rather than focusing on this obsession and escalating it to a dangerous degree. And LaDonna is right. We have been receiving, I mean, we still get harassment in all sorts of forms. We get emails, text messages, phone calls from a large group of death fetishers at this point. And one of their most recent communications, they just wanted us to know that they did feel like they should find a way to take legal action against us. They felt as if we were targeting a minority group and trying to discriminate against them.
You talked with your attorneys about having some leverage in a criminal case potentially by first filing a civil suit. Tell us about any development there.
That's my total intention, is that we will file civil suits as many as we can with the purpose of getting information in the process of discovery from these men and what few women participate in terms of the producers. So we can understand where they're making their films. Who are the models? Where are the models? Have they broken state obscenity laws? You know, do they understand the federal obscenity laws? I mean, there's a lot of information that we can glean out of a discovery process that could then eventually lead to criminal charges, particularly if they were violating laws in their communities. And many of them are. I mean, they try to operate under the radar as to avoid those things. And we just recently on our podcast interviewed a former death fetish producer, and he admitted as much. And so, you know, the process of discovery and through litigation will actually, I think, expose a lot of these people to a great degree in which they've never had any kind of accountability.
Tell us about the Deep Dark Secrets podcast.
That's a project that we're very excited about. We're about to start releasing weekly episodes. The beginning of that regular release will be on Halloween.
Interesting.
This is a podcast that I suppose we call it a fringe topic podcast. It is a true crime podcast, but we're going to be covering kind of topics on the fringe or on the outskirts of true crime. And so we thought it would be best to start with a season of death fetish episodes. So we do episodes where we talk a little bit about our relationship, our experience researching this community. And we are also covering specific producers and talking about the communities that they reside in that they could potentially be posing a threat in. In addition to that, we also cover real murder cases that tie back to the death fetish community in some way.
What about Carl Coleman's last interaction with either of you? I assume it was with LaDonna, where he knows who you are, you know who he is. Tell us about this fascinating exchange, the last one you had.
So it really came to a boiling point for all of us, really. And, you know, we have spoken and communicated, you know, directly with Carl Coleman. And, you know, he's a very interesting character, but with me, he has been very threatening. And there's been a lot of discussion about, and I want Alicia to kind of chime in here too about the shed. There's this shed that supposedly, you know, at first we weren't sure that it existed. We later discovered that it did. And lots of insinuation that perhaps that Alicia and I may be kept in that shed at some point. And so, you know, that's frightening, but lots of, you know, verbal assaults towards me, maybe not as many towards Alicia just yet when that was happening to me.
just yet.
But kind of feel like that onslaught is coming, but he's very, very angry. And I really feel like he's bent on revenge. I think that's probably a good depiction of Mr. Coleman at this point.
Yes, he's aware that there's a book that's written about him and he doesn't seem to be very pleased about that. But LaDonna's right. There's been, I would say, more direct violent threats towards her. And what comes my direction is more strange and sexual sorts of messages.
This started somewhat or in a big part from the Mickey Mouse watch connection. You looked at Mickey Mouse, the watch connection to other murders, and also the films of Carl Coleman. Tell us a little bit more about this fascinating Mickey Mouse connection.
Yes, the watch did really start this whole journey for the two of us. It was what connected LaDonna and I and what connected Melissa potentially to the death fetish community and to Carl Coleman. So it is a big part of this whole story here. And the idea that the watch was so important did lead us to kind of go back and forth about if this could be a thread connecting multiple murders, perhaps making a serial murder situation. And so research had to be done about that. And we did discover that Melissa Trotter had also been wearing a Mickey Mouse watch at the time of her abduction and murder that was not recovered as well. And through research, we've discovered another case in Texas of a young woman who was strangled to death wearing a Mickey Mouse watch. So that idea of there potentially being a serial killer who had fixated on a detail like that is still a possibility.
And still a very good possibility for Carl Coleman to be involved.
Exactly, because that third victim that we found with the watch was also in that area that he grew up in.
Very, very interesting. I want to congratulate you both, Alicia Lockhart and LaDonna Humphrey, for first off, an extraordinary book, Strangled, but this ongoing investigation that you vow to continue to look into the crimes of the death fetish community and also its ties to Melissa Wythe's murder and disappearance so many years ago. I want to thank you very much, Alicia Lockhart and LaDonna Humphrey, for coming on and talking about Strangled. For those that people might want to take another look or further look at this, is there a website, Facebook page? Tell us about some social media that they might take a look at.
I can talk about the social media and then I'll let her touch on some of the other social media we have. But we maintain whokilledmistywitt.com. You know, that site is very important. You can go to that site and get our phone number. You can communicate directly with us and you can get updates about the case. We also have a Facebook page, Who Killed Missy Wythe? You know, very easy to find. We also have an 800 number. You can call anonymously if you have any kind of information about the Wythe murder. And that is 1-800-440-1922.
Oh, yes. In addition to the Who Killed Melissa Wythe website and Facebook page, we have launched a few other locations for people to communicate with us about the death fetish community and the work that we're doing there. So probably the easiest way for people to get a hold of us is through our podcast website. It's deepdarksecretspodcast.com. And that's a good place to go if you want to listen to episodes or if you just want to contact us. There's an anonymous form area there. And we have Facebook and Instagram and a TikTok all under the same name. So it's Deep Dark Secrets Podcast.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you so much, LaDonna Humphrey and Alicia Lockhart. Thank you so much. Have a great evening.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
Good night.